Even if we never see the Blood Weaver again, we'll be meeting Silver Rank monsters sooner rather than later. The team left the lair of the dead cultists behind and went back to the task of training. They returned to the frenetic pace of when they were preparing for the confrontation with the Blood Weaver's brood, once again unsure of what numbers or monsters they would be facing. A sense of ominous danger loomed over them as they battled time and the fear that their struggles were hopeless. What came through the tunnel when it opened could very well be too much for them to handle, however strong they became. Even the most optimistic conjecture left them as a small insurgent operation against a force that had been preparing to arrive longer than any of them had been adventurers. The result was that Humphrey never felt a need to push the team. As if a wolf were snapping at their heels, the team pushed ever forward, their only guide the soul compass leading from one flesh abomination to the next. Their aggressive schedule found at least one and sometimes two or even three in a day. The compass neatly led them through the city and into the waiting embrace of monster after monster. Their lives became a war waged on the monsters of the astral space. It was a desperate race against an enemy that, for all they knew, would be impossible to overcome whatever they did. Every passing day moved them closer to the cult's arrival, but every encounter moved them closer to ready. Every member of the team was honed like a knife, not just in ability but in attitude. There were no complaints as each day blended together, training, hunting, resting, over and over. The team burned with a fire to get stronger, and they pushed themselves to their limits. Humphrey finally had to enforce a rest day at the end of each week to stop the team from burning out. They encountered the first Silver Rank monsters they actually fought instead of avoided, a pair of jungle cats with no heads but large mouths on their bellies. Although physically weaker than some top-end bronze monsters, their speed was a danger. Even Sophie wasn't able to keep up, still at Iron Rank, and she suffered a number of dangerous injuries. Belinda was almost killed outright, only Neil's powerful healing bringing her back from the brink. Ability, Grand Renewal, Renewal, Spell, Healing, Ritual. Cost, Extreme Mana. Cooldown, 1 hour. Current Rank, Bronze, 1, 14%. Effect, Iron. Conduct a powerful healing ritual that cleanses all afflictions. This ability takes the place of the ritual's material components. Effect, Bronze. The ritual circle is magically drawn, allowing the ritual to be more quickly enacted and in less ideal conditions. Neil was able to draw out a ritual circle much like Clive was, although the glowing ritual lines were green and it was only for the one specific ritual. That ritual, however, was extremely potent. Importantly, it did not require the normally costly resources of non-essence ritual healing. A monster surge lasted weeks, and was famously a time for active adventurers to advance their abilities by leaps and bounds. Not only did the team experience this phenomenon for longer than even the lengthiest monster surge, but they were not caught up defending vulnerable population centres. They had nothing to do but strike out, pushing themselves harder and harder, like an adventurous surge visited upon the monsters. Sophie inevitably reached bronze rank. Her abilities continued to follow a theme of not being flashy individually, but instead requiring skill and judgment to draw out their true potential. They were largely improvements and iterations on the iron rank effects. Belinda also reached bronze, enhancing her eclectic collection of powers. Unlike Sophie, she had a number of powers whose bronze rank effects would have a significant impact on the way she operated, and, true to form, were useful in support of the team. Her Pit of the Reaper ability would no longer cause allies to fall in. The team's most vulnerable members could stand on top of it, while anyone seeking to attack them would fall right in. Her various powers to replicate different kinds of adventurers also gained important advancement. Her Agility power, Instant Adept, gained magical movement effects such as wall running and water walking. Her Warrior replicating power, Counterfeit Combatant, now gave her access to some simple special attacks. Her Specious Sorcerer power no longer just gave her the power to wield wands and staves, but also cast some simple spells. While the power was active, she would have access to a Force Bolt spell and the same Life Bolt spell that Neil could use. The team did not just spend their time mindlessly hunting down and killing monsters. Training was also a crucial part of their preparations, delving into things that had been put aside when the Blood Weaver's army had still been ahead of them. One of the most important aspects of that training was adjusting to their new bronze rank attributes. While they had all seen their abilities increase as their attributes moved up through iron rank, there was a jump in capability as their abilities crossed the threshold of mortal potential and moved into bronze. Their new strength levels were fairly easy to adapt to, although someone already strong like Humphrey had an easier time than someone like Belinda. The real adjustment was the speed attribute, which governed agility, flexibility, dexterity, coordination, and proprioception. The two attributes combined to give the whole team a level of athleticism that was staggering and would take time to learn to its full potential. Training to make the most of their new potential brought some much-needed levity to the dour days of regimented training and ceaseless violence. They all had the agility of acrobats, and Neil became obsessed with standing backflips. The whole team took to parkour training with a new verve. Their capabilities meant not just new levels of agility, but also the power to jump further and endure longer drops than ever before. Sophie took the lead in that training, assisted by Jason. He finally pulled out the bronze rank skill books for his Way of the Reaper combat system they had won on their last trip to the astral space. They included movement techniques for speed, stealth, and the acrobatic traversal of terrain. Sophie learned from the same books the long way. They were enchanted with magical projections to act as guides, although those guides were of distinctly secondary value to Shade. The familiar was well-versed in Order of the Reaper techniques, serving as guide to both Jason and Sophie.
Miss Wexler, I am certain that at its height, the Order of the Reaper would have placed immense value on you as a recruit, he told her.
What about me? Jason asked.
They may have accepted you as well, Mr. Asano.
Jason had long wondered about the higher ranks of his martial art, which were skills rather than essence abilities. He knew theoretically that it was the techniques requiring more than human capability, but it was only getting to learn them that he truly understood. It wasn't just the strength of the power attribute and the agility of the speed attribute. There was a situational awareness that came with the spirit attribute that added a dimension to fighting that simply wasn't possible under the limits of mortal senses. As he watched Humphrey and Sophie spar, he realized that their combat had an almost choreographed feel. They thought faster, had a better sense of their opponents and their surroundings, their spatial sense much sharper. Combat was less fumbling, more precise. Mistakes were punished, but so was hesitation. None of the bronze rank techniques were reinventing the wheel, replacing existing methods wholesale. The large majority were contextual, for fighting in various circumstances and environments only made possible by bronze rank attributes. It was the movement techniques that underwent the more fundamental change. It felt awkward at first, breaking old habits that were ingrained over a lifetime. He and Sophie pushed the team through practice techniques designed to break those habits until new ones took hold. The comprehensive movement techniques of the Way of the Reaper included techniques that incorporated many common movement abilities. Jason was amused to discover a long-distance running technique similar to the one he developed himself early in his career, using the weight-reducing power of his cloak. Magical vehicles and access to Shade's mount forms had caused him to largely leave the method behind. But the Reaper technique allowed him to refine it, should he have need of it again. It was only after working to make use of their new attributes that the team truly understood how transformative bronze rank really was. It wasn't just about the increase in power, but in learning to use it to full effect. It was during this training that Jason realized just how much the bronze rankers he had seen in the past had squandered their potential. He thought he had understood why Rufus, Gary, and Farah had looked down on Greenstone's adventurers, having seen for himself how much stronger they were than the bronze rankers around them. It was only on reaching bronze rank himself, though, that he fully comprehended the difference. Their training had built a foundation over his iron rank career that now, at bronze rank, allowed him to build something truly grand upon it. Assuming the team somehow managed to overcome the cultists and find a way out of the astral space, he would have to thank Rufus and Gary properly, only now understanding just what a great service they had done for him. As for Farah, the most he could do was raise a quiet glass to the sky in her memory, as he did one night as he stood alone on the roof of his cloud house. Chapter 54. A Valiant Death.
I could feel the power he was throwing off like heat, Thadwick said, full of enthusiasm. I want that power.
And you will have it, Zato said. Dougal began the treatments earlier than you, so his power came into fullness earlier.
Dougal's new presence within the cultist enclave had not gone unnoticed. Although he remained in reclusion, all had felt the power radiating off him. They felt the instinctive drive for veneration coming from the starseeds within their souls, and saw the respect with which Timos and Zato treated him. Those who had asked about him, however, had been met with nothing but stony silence.
Why only us two? Thadwick asked. Why not give this power to everyone?
Because not everyone is worthy, Zato said. Only those of noble blood have the right to the most noble of power. Sadly, our leadership was largely lost. Dougal, like you, came to us from the nobility, and is therefore a treasure to us, like you.
I thought I heard someone say he was a servant.
No, he had servants, Zato said. Like many of the high blood, those around him grew jealous of his inherent superiority and sought to bring him down. We, of course, took him in, knowing that even a drop of noble blood is worth more than all the blood in the bodies of we commoners.
The high blood, Thadwick repeated. I haven't heard that term in a while. It isn't acceptable anymore. My great-uncle used to talk like that until Mother shushed him up. We didn't used to have to treat the rabble like their equals. I think my mother actually believes that dross. It always disgusted me about her.
You will find no such problems here.
Timos didn't seem too reverent.
Which is why I have moved you to my side. You stand above him and, in time, will stand above me. The day will soon come when your voice will be our law. The commands coming from your mouth will be our purpose.
Good, Thadwick said. I was always told that I was born to a great birthright, only to be denied at every turn. I'm glad to finally find people who understand my value.
Thadwick, Zato said with a smile. If nothing else, I can assure you that everything you deserve is coming your way. A cultist came up to them.
Leader, the man said, the church has started to arrive. Should I send people to meet them?
Not until the Archbishop appears, Zato said. Then come notify me.
The Church of Purity's members arrived at the Vane estate through a portal in lots. There were 58 in total, mostly iron rank, leavened with a solid contingent of bronze and a sole silver ranker in the person of the Archbishop. It took 3 portals to bring them all through, with the Archbishop arriving last. It had been hard times for the church members chased out of Greenstone. Only those with at least a full set of essences had been considered worth saving. The rest were abandoned to the investigations of the Adventure Society. They were too ignorant to do any damage in any case. The Archbishop, Nicholas Hendren, looked extremely disgruntled to have been summoned, although he did, with reluctance, appear. His people milled about, unsure of what to do. The cultists emerged from the cult's subterranean complex, impassively warding off anyone who approached the no longer hidden entrance. They refused to interact with the gathered clergy, unresponsive to any questions sent their way. Only once Hendren himself arrived did the cult make an approach. Timos appeared from underground, accompanied by another man hidden completely within hooded robes. Hendren frowned, both at the absence of the leader, Zato, and his inability to sense the aura of the hooded figure. If the cult had reinforced their numbers with a gold ranker, his ability to direct the course of events would be significantly hampered. They walked away from the lower-ranked cultists and clergy, Timos with the hooded figure, and Hendren with Anissa LaSalle.
Timos,
Hendren greeted brusquely. He noted the subordinate stance Timos took relative to the hooded figure. Anissa stood near Hendren in much the same posture. The figure said nothing as Timos reciprocated the greeting.
Archbishop,
Given our limited space, your people will be required to camp above ground, as I believe you have already been made aware of. Naturally, we have set aside a place for you, personally, in one of our more comfortable chambers below.
Timos turned a snide gaze on Anissa.
Will the priestess be sharing your chamber? He asked. Or remaining up here, to keep your men occupied?
Anissa's face curled up into a snarl, but she stilled at a pacifying gesture from Hendren.
Really, Timos? Hendren asked. I would hardly think this is time for such pettiness, between allies about to share an undertaking.
Some allies are more enthusiastic than others, Timos said. Of course, I did not mean to imply anything salacious. I apologize if my unwitting remarks caused your minds to naturally follow an unwelcome path.
Just have your people show mine where to set up camp, Hendren said. Then there are things in need of discussion, but not with you.
Hendren turned to the hooded figure.
Are you the new leader here? He asked.
He's the leader everywhere, Timos said. You will speak to him only when spoken to.
This is a poor way to treat allies, Hendren said.
You have been poor allies, came a voice from the hooded figure.
The voice was soft and carried no aura, yet somehow slammed into Hendren like a runaway brick cart. He immediately understood who, what, was within the robes.
Most of our people are unaware of the Lord's presence, Timos said. If you or your priestess are responsible for changing that, the repercussions will be severe.
We understand, Hendren said. Don't we, Anissa?
He was suddenly and fully aware that any influence he had would need to be persuasive, rather than authoritative, which was not where Anissa excelled.
Yes, Archbishop, Anissa said, reluctant but obediently following her superior's lead.
Priestess, work with the cult's people to see our own set up. I shall go below to discuss the next step with our allies.
Are you certain I shouldn't go with you? She asked.
Quite certain. Hendren said. Take command of our people here. Keep them in line, and make sure no one starts trouble with our allies.
He gave her a pointed look.
Words can hurt us here, priestess. Be careful that they don't.
Timos gave Anissa a smarmy smile, but after the Archbishop's warning, it was met with stony indifference. She went off to organize their people without giving Timos a second glance. Timos led Hendren into the complex below, the hooded figure of the builder silently accompanying them. Hendren noted that in addition to making no sound, the figure left no footprints in the sandy dirt that had taken over the estate grounds.
How long until the path opens?
Hendren said, as they made their way underground down the stone steps.
Days, Timos said. 2 weeks at the outside.
Iron rank monsters had become infrequent in the overgrown city. When they did appear, it was either in great numbers or alongside more powerful variations of their kind. In the first instance, the team didn't even bother to fight them, sending them fleeing with a burst of aura suppression. Only the most mindlessly aggressive were foolish enough to attack, with catastrophic results. Sophie's wind blade power alone was a disaster to weak, amassed enemies. Its strength wasn't great, but it had bronze rank power behind it. Additionally, the new effect it had gained for ranking up was that the blades grew wider as they traveled, allowing Sophie to cut down weaker enemies in clusters. Bronze rank monsters were becoming less of a challenge as the team grew their power and honed their skills. It was the increasing frequency of silver rank monsters that let them push themselves to new heights. Taking on a silver rank monster at bronze was not so easy as facing a bronze rank monster at iron. Each rank represented a larger leap in power than the last, making rank jumping a trickier proposition with each level of advancement. Silver rank monsters were easier to handle than even a mediocre silver rank essence user, but that was not the same as being easy. Only Humphrey, Jason, and Sophie were able to take on weaker, solitary silver ranks alone. Even then, they didn't try until they had consolidated their power. Only with a full grasp of their bronze rank abilities, and after advancing them into the lower midpoint of bronze, did they even attempt it. Even then, it was only weak, solitary monsters that any of them confronted alone. Such fights were uncommon, as even the silver rank monsters were appearing in packs. It was generally the most dangerous that appeared alone. The team was tearing through the city at an ever-accelerated pace, even as the monstrous opposition grew stronger. The flesh abominations no longer posed the threat they had in the past. Once the team was at bronze rank, the abomination's ability to adapt was no longer the equal of a full suite of essence powers. Belinda, especially, with her versatile powers, could adapt to an abomination faster than it could adapt to her. With their strategies tried and tested over innumerable confrontations, the abominations were no longer even worth using for practice. The team went full force to down them as quickly as possible and move on. They started clearing 2, 3, even 4 in a day, releasing hundreds of the tormented souls trapped within. The team knew they were coming close to the end of their self-imposed task, as it took longer and longer to find the abominations by following the soul compass. Eventually, the compass led them into what they realized was the new territory of the Bloodweaver. Once more, they found the residual webbing and the empty shells of converted monsters.
"The Bloodweaver will be having a harder time," Clive said. "The monsters are growing too strong. It won't be able to overpower and turn them."
"Maybe," Humphrey said. "It may have thrown weaker monsters at stronger ones in waves, then turned those stronger monsters."
"Even if that is the case," Clive said, "it won't have been able to do that more than a handful of times."
"A handful is enough," Humphrey said. "A few silver rank monsters at once is our limit, even as a team. Our abilities are growing, but if we become arrogant and complacent, we can easily die here." When the confrontation with the Bloodweaver came, there were not so many silver rank monsters as they feared. The nasty surprise was that the Bloodweaver had managed to capture and turn 3 of the flesh abominations. Vampiric power combined in dangerous ways with the nature of the flesh monsters to various effects. The first unpleasant surprise was that something about the nature of the abominations and their new vampiric state made them less vulnerable to Jason's blood powers instead of more, like the other vampiric monsters. The powers still took hold, but at a reduced strength. Fortunately, they still had increased effect against the other vampiric minions. The other aspect of the vampire abominations was that they could warp themselves to produce an array of different drain attacks. Mana, health, and stamina were all drained away by barbed flesh whips, needle claws, and eerie disjointed limbs covered in toothy maws. By the time they carved their way through to the Bloodweaver, the team was spent enough that even the relatively weak creature still posed a threat. In the end, though, they were resting atop a building that served as an anchor for the new nest, the Weaver and its minions all dead. Jason hadn't even bothered to pull out the cloud house, the team sprawling onto the tiled rooftop, exhausted. Neil had only half healed the team back up before he was too wrung out to finish the job.
"That was bad," Belinda said. "Top 5 worst fight, easy."
"Top 3, Neil said.
"I don't know about top 3, Clive said. "I mean, the Vortex Elementals were number 1, right?"
"Definitely," Jason agreed. "The Mirror Fungus was definitely top 3.
"I'd say the Stutterhawks too," Humphrey chimed in. "That's the top 3.
"Nope," Neil said. "You didn't have to heal and replenish the team through all those drain attacks. The vampire abominations were worse than the Stutterhawks."
"Actually, yeah," Clive said. "I'll accept that. Top 3.
"We really shouldn't just be lying here," Humphrey said. "A monster could jump on us while we're not defending ourselves."
"At this point, the monster can have me," Sophie said. "I'm getting some rest, even if it's the cold rest of the grave. Do you know how hard it is to get tired with my powers? This is the first time I've been genuinely tired since we left Greenstone."
"You want someone to get up? Then you get up," Neil said to Humphrey.
"All right, I will," Humphrey said, then didn't so much as twitch.
"Am I up?"
"No," Belinda said.
"Well, I tried," Humphrey said. "At least I'll be able to say I died valiantly."
"I'm bleeding on the roof," Belinda said.
"If the landlord complains, I'll lie for you," Jason said.
"That's very decent of you," Belinda said.
Eventually, the team did pick themselves up before something climbed up the side of the building to eat them, and Neil finished healing the team back up. They decamped to another location, and Jason set up the cloud house. Humphrey became everyone's hero by volunteering first watch, while everyone else except Clive went to bed. Clive made his way onto the roof, where he conducted the latest in his ongoing tests to gauge the integrity of the dimensional membrane dividing the astral space from the true astral. "Well?" Humphrey asked, as Clive came back down.
"It could be any day now," Clive said. "Not long from now, we're going to be up to our armpits in cultists."
Chapter 55. Ambitions. Over the last week, the ambient magic in the astral space had taken on a strange cadence. Like ripples on still water at the footfalls of a great beast, the very space around them was agitated. It grew stronger day by day, until even Sophie could sense it, and she had no magical senses at all. The monsters seemed affected, being driven to unusual behavior. Some hunkered down in the deepest holes they could find. Others gathered into large packs of disparate creatures that would ordinarily be at each other's throats. When the team found these groups in the early stages of their formation, before their numbers swelled, they would swoop in and wipe them out. As days passed, though, they found themselves avoiding the groups altogether. The numbers had simply grown too large to take on. Whole armies of bronze and silver rank monsters gathered, dwarfing anything the Blood Weaver had accumulated. Another reason the team had holed up in the Cloud House was that the changes to the ambient magic started to affect their powers. Sometimes they wouldn't work. Other times their effects were unpredictable, mixing up allies and enemies. Fortunately, the vampiric flesh abominations the Blood Weaver had turned were some of the last. The team knew they had cleared the last one when the soul compass spun aimlessly around.
"The strange effect on our powers will pass once the tunnel opens and the dimensional membrane becomes stable," Clive said. "That, or the whole astral space will collapse and will be annihilated. Definitely one of the two."
"I don't suppose you'd care to lay odds?" Jason asked.
"I have no idea," Clive said. "My understanding is incomplete at best. I wasn't going to say anything, but I never figured out how they intend to stabilize the tunnel at this end."
Belinda said. "Wouldn't that mean that it would essentially shred the dimensional membrane, flood the astral space with magic, and it'll do that collapsing thing you mentioned?"
"Yes,"
Clive confirmed.
"And you can't figure out why that won't happen?" Jason asked.
"That's right," Clive said. "But I'm stumbling in the dark here. We're talking about magic that I barely understand, and I've only seen parts of what they're doing."
"That's comforting," Neil said. "As far as you can tell, we're all going to die, but you know so little that you might be wrong."
"Pretty much," Clive said.
"I think I have some cake left," Jason said, opening his inventory. "If I'm going to be obliterated into astral nothingness again, I'm doing it with cake."
"What do you mean, again?" Neil asked.
Jason sat on the roof of the Cloud House, talking into a recording crystal.
"So I'm pretty sure that this whole place won't just blow up. If it does, you'll never get to see this. So I'll make a confident assertion and either come off as right, or you'll never know. So I'm a winner each way."
He turned the crystal around to point at the sky. There was a large patch that shimmered, sometimes showing a whole different sky. Stars at night, dark clouds, a strange purple. "We can see the tunnel now, so Clive thinks it's a matter of hours." He sighed, turning the crystal back on him. "I hope we're ready for whatever comes through. The last time people went up against the cultists on a large scale, I lost a friend. And that was when the opposing forces were fairly matched. I don't even know how much I'll be able to contribute. If they have a bunch of construct creatures, I may not be a lot of help."
Jason tilted his head like he was listening for something.
"Well, time to go. There probably won't be another one of these until it's all over, one way or another."
He stowed away the recording crystal.
"I'm all done, Belinda,"
he called out, and Belinda made her way up the stairs on the outside of the house.
"How did you know it was me?"
"Aura."
She shook her head. "I need to work on my aura retraction," she said.
"What's up?" he asked, waving a hand to make a cloud chair rise up for her to sit on.
"You recording another message for home?"
she asked, deflecting his question as she sat in the soft seat.
I was.
Do you think you'll ever get to show them to your family?
I hope so, he said. I have fences to mend there. I have no idea how I'm going to explain any of this. I'm not even sure that my powers will work. My world is magically barren.
Belinda let out a tired breath, looking up at the sky. This is going to be quite something, isn't it? She asked. Whether that thing kills us all, or spews out a bunch of evil pricks, this is the last bit of quiet we'll get before things get very busy and very dangerous.
Yep. Jason agreed.
It might be a last chance to maybe settle some things that have, I don't know, been hanging over us for a while,
Belinda said.
Personal stuff between members of the team.
I don't think that's a good idea, Jason said.
Oh, come on. You know she likes you.
I know, Jason said.
Which leads me to question why you're the one up here. You may have noticed that she's not exactly great at making herself vulnerable,
Belinda said.
She doesn't know what to do.
I think it's best left alone, Jason said. Even if we put aside the tangle of issues around how we met, which we can't, it isn't... I don't... He sighed. Sophie's good at cutting through the nonsense to get to the point. That's something people like me need in their lives. And she's gorgeous, obviously. But that's where the attraction ends for me. I want her in my life and in my team. Neither of us are easy friends to have, but we both make good ones, I think. That's what I want. All I want.
Ah, crap, Belinda said.
Yeah, Jason said. That about covers it.
What do we do?
Nothing, Jason said. She has to decide for herself what course she's going to take.
And if that course leads straight to you?
Belinda asked. Then she and I will have an awkward conversation and we'll figure it out from there. She needs to find herself as an adventurer before she starts adding complications anyway. Not the running around hunting monsters part of being an adventurer. She's a natural at that.
Yes, she is,
Belinda agreed. I mean the place in society that being an adventurer brings. The power and privilege, the money. That's where she's going to need you.
I'm not just her sidekick, you know.
I know.
I have my own hopes and ambitions. I don't want to just spend my life trailing her around.
I never thought you did, Jason said. But you're the one having this conversation when it really should be her. You may need to consider if she's the one trailing you around.
She's just not good at certain things, Belinda said. She doesn't handle them well. I don't want her to run off or kick the snot out of you or something.
I appreciate that, Jason said. So where do you see yourself landing down the line, assuming we survive to escape this mess?
I'm liking this adventuring job, Belinda said. Not so much the hunting down monsters, but roaming around, tackling interesting problems. I guess I want to end up somewhere between Clive and Amir. Well studied, but not bound up in the magic society the way Clive is. Taking interesting jobs for large quantities of money, but going out there myself, getting my hands dirty. I don't want to be a spider in the middle of a web, like Amir.
A life of excitement, travel, and adventure, Jason said. That sounds exactly like the direction the team should be going. Maybe you should be in charge.
That works for me, Belinda said. I can have Sophie follow me around and clean up my messes for once.
The sky distortion was directly over the center of the city. The team had chosen to wait out events from atop a building on the outskirts of the central region, on one of the last intact buildings before the thick ring of jungle took over. Jason had set the cloud house up on the roof. Unlike many other aspects of magic, the cloud flask seemed unaffected by the changes in ambient magic. Clive explained that they had only seen a fragment of the true artistry behind its construction. When the ground started shaking like an earthquake, they all made their way outside.
Should we get down off this building? Neil asked. It feels like the building is going to collapse.
Let's go up on the cloud house roof, Jason said. I'm pretty sure it will slow fall us down if the building gets earthquaked out from under us.
Pretty sure? Neil asked.
The team made their way onto the roof of the cloud house, itself on the roof of a tall building, giving them a good vantage. At the very centre of the city was the crater that was once the Order of the Reaper's trial tower. They couldn't see the ground level there due to the intervening buildings, but they heard a cacophonous shattering of earth and stone. Then a huge cloud of dust and dirt rose up, spreading over the city. Sophie's toxin-purging aura created a field of clean air around the team as the cloud washed around and past them. After a few moments, the cloud settled enough for the team to once again see out over the city. In the space over the crater was a giant stone ring, floating horizontally in the air. It was thick and some 100 meters across, slowly ascending through the air in the direction of the sky anomaly.
"I don't remember seeing that," Sophie said. "It feels like we would have noticed something that large."
"It must have been buried," Humphrey said. "That cloud was kicked off when it pushed itself out." "Any ideas, Clive?"
"All I can offer are guesses," Clive said. "I'm assuming some manner of terminus point for the tunnel to stop it from annihilating the astral space."
"That's good news," Neil said. "We'll survive long enough to get wiped out by a cultist army."
"Maybe it will stabilize the magic," Clive said. "Open up the portals and give us a chance to escape."
"Escape isn't an option," Humphrey said. "Unless the limit on Iron Rank entry has been changed, we're the only ones with the strength to stop the cult. Bringing in more Iron Rankers would be animals to the slaughterhouse. The monsters would get them before the cultists did."
"Assuming we do have the strength," Belinda said.
"I'm assuming that," Humphrey said. "It's the only chance we have of stopping whatever it is they're doing, which we very much want to do." The team watched the ring slowly rise into the air.
"I believe it is called a ring gate,"
Shade said, emerging from Jason's shadow.
"I've heard of them, but never seen one in operation. As Mr. Standish surmised, it is likely the anchor point of the physical reality bridge spanning across the astral between this space and your world."
"An artificial astral space aperture," Clive said.
"Yes."
"You didn't feel like mentioning this before?" Neil asked.
"My knowledge in this area is limited," Shade said. "Even now, I postulate."
The ring continued its ponderous rise into the sky.
"How long has that thing been there, hidden under the ground?" Sophie wondered. "During my return here, it has become clear that many things were kept from me when I was made administrator of this place," Shade said. "We have gone places I did not know existed and were apparently barred to the vessel I inhabited at that time."
"They didn't want you to know," Jason said.
"I believe that to be the case," Shade said. "It seems to have an age and purpose that goes well beyond the training ground it served as during my tenure here. The Order of the Reaper and my previous summoner clearly hid that history and purpose from me."
"Should we, I don't know, get ready to attack?" Neil asked. "Catch them as they arrive?" "No," Humphrey said. "We have to assume that we'll be outnumbered, and that the enemy will have at least some silver rankers amongst them. We have to make every move with careful deliberation." "Insurgency rules," Jason said. "Guerrilla tactics. Find vulnerable points, soften them up. Create a chance to strike critical points."
"Exactly," Humphrey said. "We've been tramping over this place for the last 5 months. We know it better than they do, and we need to use that."
"The first thing we need is information," Clive said.
"Yes," Humphrey said. "We need to see what comes through that ring." "It is in the sky," Sophie said. "Maybe they'll all just fall down and die."
"That would be nice," Humphrey said. "Somehow, I don't think it's going to be that easy." In the sky of the astral space, the ring finally came into contact with the shimmering anomaly. Immediately, the anomaly began to shrink down, pouring into the space within the ring like water going down a drain. The anomaly concentrated. What was originally an occasionally shifting skyscape became a roiling mass of indiscernible power within the ring. Then, the roiling stopped. A swell of magic flooded over the city, like the blast wave of an explosion, as the space inside the ring became the still, dark blue of the sky before sunset. Watching from far below, reeling from the magical blast, Jason and his team watched as a figure that seemed incredibly tiny at that distance fell out of the ring. Shrouded in blue light, it drifted slowly towards the ground. More figures emerged, dropping through the ring and falling to the ground in rapid succession. The team counted dozens, and it was more than just people. There were large boxes, likewise slowly falling under the power of the blue light, all descending towards the ground at the heart of the city.
"That's a lot," Neil said.
"Yep," Jason agreed.
"Can we handle all that?"
"We will," Humphrey said.
"So what now?" Sophie asked. "We need more information, right?"
"We do," Jason said. "I think I'll start by taking a look at what they're up to."
Chapter 56 Faith and Glory. The power of the ring gate let the cultists drift down from the sky in safety, but they descended into trouble. The cultists drew more than a little attention on their way down, the blue light slowing their fall, making them stand out both visibly and magically. The result was a slavering pack of monsters awaiting them on the ground. The center of the city had not been monster-free for some time. The Blood Weaver was long gone, but even if it hadn't been, the increasing magical density produced monsters with power enough to rival it easily. The magical saturation that had the monsters manifesting thick and fast meant that the center of the city was now just as infested as the rest. The cultists descending first would need to fight out a safe zone for those that followed, but the monsters awaiting them were well beyond their expectations, both in number and power. The bronze rankers were able to hold their own against the gaggle of monsters moving in on their location. They were lucky in that no silver rank monsters had yet appeared. The bronze rankers were not able to carve out a space for those that followed, however. Their fellows dropped right into the jaws of battle. Meanwhile, more monsters poured in, hungry for the prey being dropped from heaven. The iron rankers that arrived quickly fell prey to the powerful monsters, as the bronze rankers were too busy to protect them. Rather than a landing zone, all they had managed to create was a battle zone. It was the arrival of the builder's hooded figure that overturned the situation. Spears made of elaborately carved stone erupted from the ground in clusters, impaling monsters as many as a dozen times. Grand walls, thick and high, rose up in a circle to box out the more widely spread monsters and isolate the closest ones. The bronze rankers fell on the monsters that survived the spears, quickly establishing the landing zone they had failed to create alone. The walls were not the solid stone of crude stone-shaping powers, but brick and mortar, complete with battlements, observation towers, and metal gates in each of the four directions. The result was larger and more elaborate than any silver rank essence user could conjure up. There was a command tent at the heart of the fortified camp. It was magically shielded against prying eyes and ears and contained a round table with four chairs. Within were two occupants. Zato was sitting and the builder standing.
"Establishing this base camp has overtaxed this vessel," the builder told Zato. "It is beginning to break down."
Evidence of the breakdown was readily apparent. The body of Dougal that the builder inhabited had fiercely bloodshot eyes, sunken flesh, and gaunt, pallid skin. Hair had fallen out in ugly clumps.
"The new vessel is ready to be inhabited," Zato said. "We are working on a third just as a contingency."
"It should not be necessary, but I applaud your preparedness," the builder said. "So long as I do not use the kind of power that built these walls again, the next vessel should comfortably see us through our task here. Since this one is close to being spent, I will make some more buildings and establish a true fort instead of these tents."
"There is one problem with the next vessel," Zato said.
"It has realized that it will be a hollowed-out puppet."
"Yes," Zato said.
"Not a concern," the builder said. "Unlike the previous transferal, I am here to participate in person. Resistance will not pose any impediment to the process. This vessel still has a few days before it becomes unusable, so prepare accordingly."
"Yes, Lord Builder."
"Make sure to kill this vessel once I am done with it. It will be little more than a walking hunger once I have left it.
I do not need to explain why having an energy vampire roaming around would be a poor idea, even if it would quickly starve. I'll see to it, Lord Builder.
Timos arrived at the tent, along with the Archbishop, Nicholas Hendren. After announcing them from the outside, Timos led Hendren inside before leaving again.
Please sit, Zato said, getting up. Hendren sat and looked at the builder. It was his first time seeing the vessel without it being hidden beneath a hood.
Are you all right? Hendren asked.
This vessel channeled too much of my power establishing this camp, the builder said. I will be taking another soon.
The Mercer boy? Hendren asked. Is that what he was yelling and screaming over?
It is.
The boy is an idiot, Hendren said. His mother spent every scrap of influence she had to make sure he would not have his star seed purged until we had a safe method. Then he runs right back to you, an imbecile.
Your role in that affair is worthy of praise, the builder told Hendren. My people made a rash choice in implanting star seeds as a distraction. It gave those who would fight us too much information. Placing yourself in the middle and slowing the process of removing those seeds to a crawl was the bold move of an effective ally. Your side and mine have both made mistakes, but individually, you have my respect.
The respect of an ally is a valuable thing, Hendren said diplomatically, then turned to Zato. May I inquire why you asked me specifically to exclude Princess LaSalle from this meeting?
The priestess is a woman of zeal, Zato said. The strength of her faith is a testament to your god. That kind of dedication can be inflexible, however, when circumstances dictate compromise. As a gesture of goodwill, I have likewise excluded my own second from this meeting.
Hendren gave a reluctant nod.
Anissa is unflinchingly dedicated, but, as you say, she can be reluctant to adapt. She gets caught up in the way she feels things should be, instead of accepting them the way they are.
Circumstances here are not as they should be, Zato said. The unanticipated change to the magical density will require a number of hard decisions.
The monsters are certainly too strong for our iron rank people, Hendren said. Do you know what caused it?
Our original astral magic specialist was lost some time ago, Zato said.
Landemir Vane, Hendren said. It seems Jason Asano was always destined to plague this enterprise.
A flash of rage crossed the face of the builder's vessel, accompanied by a burst of aura that was brief, yet enough to leave the other two swaying unsteadily in their seats. The sounds of the camp outside were stilled to silence as the aura passed over it. The two men waited to see if the builder would speak, but he said nothing.
The specifics are irrelevant, Zato eventually continued. It seems that our other ritualists made an error in the tunnel formation. Sadly, it was all set in motion months ago before the Lord Builder was on hand to guide us. They were unable to grasp an element of the design Vane left behind, so they improvised, substituting in another aspect of dimensional magic. That alteration had no effects apparent from the other side, but we are working with potent dimensional forces. A tiny change became a dangerous fluctuation by the time the bridge was affecting the astral space.
You didn't realize? Hendren asked, turning to the builder.
The senses of this vessel are limited, the builder said. As for this realm, I can only see into physical realities through a vessel or those who carry my seed. That includes a borderline physical space such as this one.
What happened exactly?
The dimensional membrane of this world was disrupted, causing a rapid alteration in the magical density. The builder said. The ring gate has stabilized the tunnel and the plan continues. But the strength of the monsters represent an unanticipated obstacle that will need to be accounted for. The practical result, Zato said, is that our people are too weak to carry out the plan. Your people, too.
Iron rankers cannot be sent out under these conditions, even with bronze rank supervision. There are silver rank monsters out there, and not just a few. Do you trust your bronze rankers to handle a pack of silvers? That takes elite and experienced essence users.
Adventurers, Hendren said.
Yes, Zato agreed. I know your clergy had some Adventure Society members, as does our number, but none full-time. Neither of us have the people to handle this in the numbers we need, especially given that the strength of the monsters is not the only reason to be concerned about them.
The changes in the ambient magic has agitated the monsters, the builder said. It has altered their behavior to a degree we don't yet know. They may settle as the ambient magic does the same, but there are no certainties. As it stands, the groups out there are more dangerous than normal monster packs.
What about construct creatures?
Hendren asked. They will be an integral part of our response, Zato said. We still retain a supply of clockwork cores that we will be using to build up a force of constructs. The weakness of constructs is that they need direction. They can supplement the strength of our people, but not replace it. We need more people who can operate independently in this monster environment. We cannot send teams out on tasks if they all need our strongest people to protect them.
I'm not sure what you want from me, Hendren said. I can't just bump all my people up to bronze rank.
I can, the builder said.
Excuse me? Hendren asked.
I can remake your iron rankers into bronze rankers.
How is that possible? Why haven't you done it to your own people?
Because my followers are the price, the builder said. I can sacrifice an iron rank follower with a starseed to create a special kind of clockwork core. It can be used to raise another iron ranker to bronze. I will sacrifice my iron rank follower to make yours powerful enough to contribute.
No, Hendren said, flatly. We are the Church of Purity, in case you have forgotten. We are not going to taint ourselves in the name of short-term power.
No, the builder asked. What do you think this pact between myself and your god is? Your deity knows that its objectives cannot be met alone. Without a power from beyond your world, the other gods would stop any attempt to enact your god's grand agenda.
I do not presume to know my god's purpose, Hendren said. My role is to serve, to obey.
You don't even know what your god is after? Zato asked incredulously.
The truth is hidden from us, that we cannot despoil our god's plans should we be compromised. Hendren said. We do not need to know our god's design. We have faith. We are willing to put aside our base mortal perspectives and surrender ourselves to a higher power, one that knows better than us, that is better than us.
Surely it had occurred to you that my intrusion on this world is itself a form of impurity, the builder said. Yet your god participates.
Why?
Because there will come a time when my agenda is done and I will be gone. It is then that your god will have a chance to undertake a great purge in a world reeling from the damage I have left in my wake, to cleanse the filth and make a world that is clean. While the power structures that would resist you are fighting me, your church will be preparing to move in when I am gone, and they are at their most vulnerable.
So you say? Hendren said. I would not presume to know the intentions of my god.
And, in this place, you cannot ask, the builder said. This realm is outside your world, therefore beyond your god's authority. He has no eye to see, no voice to speak, no hand to move. You are his highest agent here, Nicholas Hendren. What did your god advise you? Before you came here.
To do what is necessary, Hendren said.
Your god understands the reality, the builder said. That compromise today means purity tomorrow. Yes, there will be sacrifices.
These people of yours, once we empower them, their purpose and destiny will be fixed. They will serve as necessary, and then you will purge them once the work is done."
"I cannot ask this of my people," Hendren said.
"Faith is about surrendering to a higher power," Zato said. "Your words, Archbishop. Does purity's clergy serve only when they want to, or when they are called? What greater honor is there than sacrifice in the service of your God?"
"You can't ask it of my people either," Hendren said.
"Making the sacrifice of your people is a burden you will have to bear," Zato continued. "For it is not a sacrifice in which you will share. You will have to remember them, honor them, let them be your symbol, your martyrs. What you do here will show your God that you can be more. A greater servant, making the decisions that a leader must make. It is your chance to prove yourself worthy of taking a larger role in the service of your God."
Hendren frowned, looking down at the table in front of him. The absence of his God's voice troubled him, but it also made him the highest moral authority in the realm in which he found himself. In a way, that made his decisions right, for the simple reason that he made them, as was the case with his God.
"Very well," Hendren said, then looked up from the table to meet the ruined eyes of the builder's vessel.
"I will need time to bring LaSalle around. She will need to be convinced to create a unified front."
"Of course," Zato said. "We have our own preparations to make, our own sacrifices to prepare."
Anissa, as it turned out, was far less of a concern than Hendren had feared.
"We must not be short-sighted," she said, in response to his explanation. "No sacrifice is too great in service of the God. Even amongst our clergy, few are truly worthy, truly pure. Only those like you and I must be completely vouchsafed. For the rest, sacrifice in furtherance of our God's agenda is a greater glory than they deserve or have any right to expect."
Thadwick sat forlornly in a cage, arms hugged around his legs. With the arrival of the cult in the astral space, he had finally felt the full power of Dougal on display. He finally came to realize that the power he had been offered would never be his to control, that he was nothing but a cup, to be filled and held in the hand of another. The power inside him that had brought him to bronze rank at the cost of his essence powers had felt so grand, so potent. Now it felt alien, a threat he could not escape because it was already inside of him. Head bowed, Thadwick did not see the shadowy figure of Shade step through the bars. What he did recognize was the hated voice that emerged from Shade's body.
"Hello, Thadwick.
It's been a while." Chapter 57. Thadwick. Shade's passage through the cultist camp had been easier than anticipated. The camp was divided into three parts. The section with tents, which was his access point, was the largest. It was where the bulk of both groups of the Iron Rankers were gathered. The crude buildings made with a stone-shaping power were areas he tried to avoid, as one of the Bronze Rankers there might have been sharp enough to spot Shade. The very few buildings that looked like they were put together by a skilled craftsperson he completely avoided. The last thing he wanted was to run into a Silver Ranker, or, if Clive's guess was right, even the Builder itself. Clive knew more than most about great astral beings, even venerating one himself. That was how he knew it was possible for them to occupy a human vessel, although the process was far from ethical. Using Shade's body hidden in the shadows, Jason listened to conversations and quickly confirmed Clive's suspicions, then extracted his perception from Shade. His actual body was on the ground floor of a large intact building.
"It's like you suspected," Jason told Clive. "The Builder has taken a mortal vessel."
"I knew those were more than even a Silver Ranker could stone shape," Neil said.
"What's next?" Sophie asked.
"I'm going back there," Jason said.
"That's a mistake," Clive said.
If the Builder really is there, even in a mortal vessel, it's likely to find you sooner rather than later. It may even be able to trace you through the familiar bond.
So you mentioned earlier, Jason said. I'd actually like to talk to you about that, Clive.
Thadwick's cage was by the wall, moulded by a stone-shaping power from the brick underfoot. The process to prepare him to be the Builder's next vessel had given him strength in the upper reaches of bronze, so the bars were thick and reinforced with containment magic. Thadwick's essence powers were gone, so he wore no suppression collar. The cage had been placed out of the way, behind a pile of damaged storage crates. The circumstances in which the cultists had arrived had been as savage on their supplies as it had on their members. The worthless and broken goods had been tossed aside in a pile, and Thadwick with them. Thadwick was sitting head down, legs pulled up with his arms around them. Shade's incorporeal body slipped right through the bars into a crouch.
Hello, Thadwick, Jason greeted through his familiar. It's been a while.
On hearing Jason's hated voice, Thadwick lifted his head. His hands snaked out to grab the shadowy figure by the throat, but passed straight through it.
I'm not really here, Thadwick. I'm speaking through one of my familiar's projected bodies. Even if you could kill it, it would only cost me some mana to replace.
You survived then, Thadwick said bitterly. We weren't sure if you would be able to stay alive in this place.
I don't think anyone doubted it but you, Thadwick. This place has its dangers, but not so many that a good team of adventurers can't handle it. Neil says hello, by the way.
I don't want to hear from that traitor.
Wow, Jason said. Your aura has changed more than mine, to the point I wasn't sure it was really you. But calling someone a traitor after you kicked him out of your team so you could sign up with an evil cult, that's you all over.
And smugly looking down on others is you, Thadwick spat back.
That's fair, Jason said. We're both so far from that day we met in the marshalling yard, yet our flaws remain the same. That being said, I had something of a revelation in the time since we last met.
And what's that? Thadwick asked skeptically.
That you and I are more similar than either of us would like.
I'm nothing like you.
Say it all you like, but it doesn't change anything. It's not like I can claim any credit for the differences that led you to be stuck in this cage, while I'm free to come and go. I just had the good fortune of having people who reined me in before I turned into you.
You think you're so much better than me, don't you, Asano?
Jason smiled sadly, shaking his head.
Thadwick, everyone is better than you. You were literally the worst. You didn't just betray your family and the Adventure Society, although you most certainly did that. These people you've thrown in with, they're the enemy of the whole world and everyone in it. You betrayed your entire world. You're worse than people who beat their children or rob and kill the elderly. You're worse than the cultists you've joined. They might follow some twisted, power-hungry ideology, but at least they act out of passion. They didn't just look at someone else causing death and destruction on a global scale and join in out of pique because the world didn't give them what they felt they were entitled to. You think you understand me?
Yes, Thadwick. Not to kick a man when he's down, but you're a bit simple.
Thadwick lashed out again, his hand once more swiping harmlessly through Shade's shadow body.
Also, a little slow on the uptake, Jason added.
Screw you, Asano. You'll never get out of this astral space alive.
Maybe, Jason said. If I die, though, I die as myself. While my familiar was poking around, I pieced together how you ended up in this cage. The Builder's really here in person, walking around inside some poor sap?
He is, Thadwick said, the disdain in his voice pushed out by dread. He used too much power building this camp, and all but burned out his current vessel.